Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey guys, it's Lisa Stanley, your Rent-A-Yenta. And today on my podcast, What Goes On Around Here, we have actor, musician, and author, Sam Witwer, best known for playing Crashdown in Battlestar Galactica, a vampire in the hit TV show Being Human, and, well, you may recognize his voice since he is Darth Maul in Star Wars. I don't do a good impersonation, he will do it all.
That's great.
And here
it's
he
really
is.
Good. You're going to take a job from me. This is not cool.
I'm not going to take any jobs from you.
That's
hi,
cool.
Sam.
Hi, Lisa. How are you doing?
I am so happy you are on the podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
So Sam and I know each other because we were fortunate enough, it's been about 4 years now, yeah?
It has, yeah.
About 4 years ago to be part of a Toyota's Celebrity Grand, Grand Prix, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
The Celebrity Grand Prix races.
Yes.
We had a good time. I sucked, but Sam did pretty good.
I did all right, aside from the fact that I spun out in the actual race.
Yeah.
And managed to get back on track.
But it was Corbin who really crashed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we had some serious wipeouts.
We did have
and
some.
Not only that, but in the practices, we had wipeouts.
Practices were deadly.
High mortality rate in this particular group.
So that's how I met Sam. We've kept in touch over the years. I just adore him. He is just the coolest dude in the world. And so here he is to tell us all about Sam. And let's start with where you grew up in Glenview, Illinois, a little place outside of Chicago. And tell us a little bit about growing up. I know you have a brother.
Yes, indeed. My brother, Michael Witwer, who I co-wrote the Dungeons and Dragons book that we haven't talked about yet.
We will.
But yeah, Glenview, Illinois. Just, you got to picture John Hughes movies because it's around there that he shot a lot of that stuff. And it's
Breakfast Club type of movies?
Well, I'll tell you what, the Breakfast Club High School is within, 5 minutes drive distance from the house that I grew up in.
Oh, how cool is that?
So yeah, I think I thought I was Bender. I think that's who I thought I was. But yeah, it was John Hughes land. John Hughes grew up around there. He shot a lot of his stuff around there. And so when people go, oh, you know, John Hughes, that was my childhood. I'd be like, That was my childhood.
You only have one brother?
One brother.
Yeah. No sisters. And your brother, like you mentioned, which we're going to get into later on, helped you co-write this book, Dungeons and Dragons. And is he a writer, your brother?
Yes, he is.
Or actor, both?
He's done a little bit of everything, but he's getting his feet wet in the author thing. This book that we're looking at is his second and my first.
This book is so freaking gorgeous. I mean, talk about a coffee table piece. Yeah. This is a looker.
It's also heavy. Like, you could hurt someone with this thing.
Oh,
like,
well, that's good to know. Someone. So if someone comes in unexpectedly, you just pick up your Dungeons and Dragons book.
It has many uses. Many uses.
All right. So listen, your mom and dad, not in the business.
No.
And how did they feel? At what age did you decide you were going to be taking this course?
Well, when I was young, I thought I wanted to be an actor, but then I actually grew out of it. I actually was like, that's not realistic. You can't be.
In drama though in school?
I was, but I transitioned to that just being a hobby, like being for fun, because I was like, there's no way some kid from Glenview can go and be an actor. So I came up with essentially a much more realistic idea of what my life would be. I was like, I'm going to be a rock star. So
that's the other thing. He does music. He's got a brand new indie album out, which we'll talk about as well. But so
from
wait.
One unrealistic goal to another. And then what happened was I was not doing great in high school academically. I was doing great when it came to doing plays and doing shows and comedy stuff and whatever whatever extracurricular things I was doing really great. Grades, not so much. And my parents were like, you should go to college. And I was like, cool, Dad. How am I going to do that? You know? And because I had long hair at the time. So, you know, and they were like, well, listen, you like drama, right? Says my parents. And I said, yeah, but it's for fun. And they're like, well, when you audition for the drama division in certain schools, they sometimes are easy on your grades because they think, well, you're an actor. You're not supposed to know about math and stuff like that.
Oh, kind of like a sports situation.
Not that sports situation. No. They did not. There were no photographs taken of me doing things I don't do. But like, just to leave that alone for a second. Basically, yes, they generally go easy on your grades a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit if you're auditioning. But you do have to audition for these schools. And one of the schools that I auditioned for, I thought it was a big waste of time to go audition for this school because they only took 20 people a year. And that's the school that took me. This particular school doesn't look at your grades at all.
They just look at your talent.
Just the audit. Well, yeah, I guess.
I mean, that's what it boils down to.
Sorta, I guess. And that was Juilliard. So yes. I am like this long-haired.
Excuse me. Oh,
God.
That was Juilliard. Well, hello, Z.
Yeah.
Do you know how many people die to go to Juilliard that want to be in the business?
Well, what was funny was walking into that audition with like ripped jeans and like long hair and just a t-shirt and looking like just a loser. And everyone else was dressed really nice and everyone was doing weird exercises. And I was like, I don't even know what I'm doing here, man. And I even told them that.
Well, they were thespians.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. And so my irreverent attitude, I think, helped me get into that school. But then, funny enough, that same irreverent attitude helped me get invited to leave that school two years later.
Oh, so, really?
Oh, yeah.
They kicked you out?
Yeah. Well, no, they invited me to leave.
Oh, they.
And I took their invitation. I was like, should
I? How does that go down?
They asked me, and
they
said,
yeah. Would you like to leave?
I said, yeah, no, yeah. This hurts my ego. What is going on here? Yeah.
But in high school, besides drama classes, you were a lead singer in a high school band called Love Plumber.
How the hell do you know that? That's not. We shouldn't be saying that.
What kind of a name is Love Plumber?
It's a terrible name. It's a really bad name.
Who named that?
Me?
I wonder why it didn't go anywhere.
The lead singer of Love Plumber has been asked to leave Julia. What? Not Love Plumber. Not them. The paradigm of society.
I mean, come on.
Oh,
I mean, come on.
Yeah,
Love Plumber.
Seriously.
I cracked up. When I read that, I was cracking
so
up.
So many things that I've spent a lot of time on are really dumb. And Love Plumber.
But they've got you where you are today.
I guess, sort of, yeah.
All right, so you get asked to leave Juilliard,
yeah.
But you still want to act now, right?
Well, no. Yes. Well, the moment I left, Juilliard, you
yes.
see that?
Yeah, I like how you said
I changed
that.
The
yeah.
narrative. I left them. You can't fire me. I quit. no, but the whole thing was, it wasn't like, What was fun was that there were some kids in high school that liked to make up rumors that the reason I was asked to leave Juilliard was because I was like a heroin addict or something. It was amazing.
You?
Yeah, we had a very... Yeah, I know. You know me, right?
I know you, and that is the furthest thing ever.
But there were some really great stories that I
heard.
He
doesn't even take cream in his coffee,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
I mean,
but
come on.
I don't drink or anything like that. But the truth was, I was just, I loved some of the things they were teaching and didn't have any regard for the other stuff. So they were
so
like.
So you were like a cafeteria, Juilliard person.
And that was a great cafeteria, let me tell you. It was incredible. Every day walking.
You pick and choose what you want.
You eat it.
Yeah.
Every day. But yeah, so I was more of, I had more of an a la carte thing with Juilliard where I was like, I love this voice and speech stuff. I don't necessarily understand all of this movement stuff. I was selective. I don't care as much about the theater history stuff, although I respect it. I care more about that now, funny enough.
Obviously.
So once I was asked to leave Juilliard School of Drama.
I wonder if you're the only person ever asked to leave. I'm just curious.
Sure.
I mean, I'm just curious how many people have been asked to
leave. Robin Williams wasn't asked to leave at all.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that was the whole thing, is that people that went on to do, you know, look, I got people who probably among the faculty, there was probably the opinion of some people that I didn't maybe didn't belong there. There were probably some people who thought I was no good. There were some people who thought I was really good and told
me so. Do you
think
that the people that thought you didn't belong there just were basing it on the way you came in with your torn jeans and your crappy outfit on? Do you think that's what it was?
Let's revise the narrative, shall we? Let's say that they loved that free spirit, and they wanted to tame it, and I wouldn't be tamed. No. I mean, look, the fact is that I just... It wasn't a good fit for me, but I got some really wonderful encouragement from some of the founding members on my way out. And in fact, one of them, who will remain nameless because he swore to me that he would hurt me if I ever told anyone he said this.
Is it somebody we would all know, though?
No, but
okay.
But he is someone who has saved a franchise or two that I can't even talk about because then people would know who he is.
Okay.
But like he's come in and troubleshoot some things.
Okay.
There's some things that are very near and dear to our hearts. But he said, listen, this school does take something from some actors, and you are one of the actors that has something that we probably shouldn't take from you.
And what was that?
I don't know. To this day, I have no idea what he's talking about.
Do you think it could just be the fact that you're so alive and the fact that you are... No, you know what I mean? Because sometimes you get suppressed into things.
The school at that time did have a reputation. I'm only learning this now from directors in L.A., that everyone coming out of the school was talking like this and they were perfect to Julia. And I think what he was saying is, no, this weird thing that you
bring to the
individuality,
table.
Maybe you need to go and con people into giving you money for that rather than us training you out of it.
Right.
Because they do teach you how to walk.
Because they were trying to suppress who you were.
They were trying to
suppress.
That's right, dude.
Damn it.
Yeah. No, but they do. In fact, you know, I spent 2 years there with people critiquing how you walk and talk.
Isn't that amazing?
But the idea, yeah. So it's
such a renowned school.
They do it a little differently now.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they do.
Oh, good.
They
must have been told by other people that it just it wasn't working.
But I'll tell you this though: as much as I'm giving them some crap, and by the way, some of the crap that me and other people that I went to that school with, some of the crap that we give them, we now that we're professionals know that they deserved it.
Ah.
Having said that, some of the teachers there were incredible. Like you know, look, I'll talk about this Star Wars habit that I have. If it weren't for Ralph Zito at Juilliard, I never would have gotten those Star Wars gigs because he was the one that really gave me an awareness of what the hell I was doing with my voice and speech.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I used his Juilliard training for evil.
Oh,
so,
well, that worked out well.
So
what was your first paid acting gig?
I was a ninja in a Chicago Bulls commercial.
Really?
Yeah, I showed up to this audition and they were like, so we're having martial artists come in. Are you a martial artist? Says someone in Chicago to me. And I'm like, well, yeah. And I'm not. And so I went in and they lined me up against all these martial artists. And they were literally went down the road like, okay, do a martial arts routine. And I'm standing there going, oh, no.
Oh, no.
So then a guy like to my right would do like a flip and a kick and this and that.
Oh.
And then another guy would like, you know, maybe have nunchucks or something like that. And I'm like, okay, Bruce Lee movies, Enter the Dragon. Okay, what would he do? And then I started just doing this stuff, like, you know.
Like crazy stuff.
I did crazy stuff. And to my shock, I remember immediately after I did this crazy thing, like with my hands and my this and that and punches and kicks. And the guys next to me looked at me like, whoa, wow, this guy knows his stuff. And I was like, oh, my God, are you kidding me?
Faked out,
and
buddy.
And I got me and like two or three others got the job. Now, the thing is, I was wildly unqualified for this job. So I had to like leap from a small table in some very rich person's house on the North Shore of Lake Michigan, in some mansion we were shooting in. And there were all these expensive, you know, furniture pieces.
How old were you?
I'm 19 or 20.
19, 20, yeah.
You know,
you're fresh, fresh.
Fresh out of getting kicked out of Juilliard.
Fresh out of getting kicked out.
And so I'm standing on this little table and they're like, and you, they point to me, do like a double kick in the air and then land between this table and this couch. Very expensive table.
Oh, now they're choreographing your non-move.
And I'm supposed to do a double kick over this one ninja and land the thing in a certain position. And I'm
How'd
like.
How'd that work out?
I will tell you this. I did not break the table. Every take, I did land where I was supposed to land, did the kick. We were all supposed to do martial arts things at the same time. And then for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I walked with a limp. That's basically it. I'm not kidding you. For the next 2 to 3 weeks, I was taxing myself beyond. And what's great is it took them 6 months to pay me. So walk with a limp for 3 weeks, 6 months to pay me like $400. It was great.
So did you continue doing commercials or did you go right into doing episodics and TV stuff in that way?
No. I was very lucky because I had a parent's basement to hide in because I would get little things in Chicago and like hand the money over to my parents because I was staying in their basement. But I couldn't get arrested in Chicago, even for theater.
Well, it's a difficult place to work anyway.
Don't
you
make
have
excuses.
To come to L.A., right?
Don't make excuses for me. Maybe I sucked. I remember going to an audition for a theater thing and like an idiot doing a bit like, okay, Sam, what will you show us? I'm like, okay, well, let me warm up first. And I did like I warmed up. In front of, and
how do you
then,
warm up? What's
like,
your warm up?
All that.
Oh, like you're going to sing?
Well, no, just vocal warm ups and stretching. And it didn't occur to me.
You do that before you do your voices?
What you want to do is do that before you walk into the audition, not in front of the people you're auditioning for. So, that's how I learned that. I was like, oh, bad idea, huh? So the good news is, while I couldn't get arrested in Chicago, I was making all of the dumbass mistakes in Chicago
before
I came to L.A.
Right, that's great. So you come to L.A., did it always start like this for your career, all these dark characters?
No. Well, no. I mean, it was, I think, my first job in L.A., which was after, I think, about a year of auditioning.
Was that Battlestar?
No. It was like a two-line role on JAG.
Oh!
And I was like, sup. How's it going, Vic? Those are my two lines. Sup and how's it going, Vic? Now, I want to point out, sup was an ad-lib.
Yeah, oh.
Boom, I'm popping the collar. My collar is being popped as we speak. For me, having floundered around and also having been, you know, asked very, you know, the humiliation of having been asked to leave Juilliard and then living in my parents' basement while I was trying to figure out what the hell to do and how to become an actor.
How did they take it, by the way, when you were asked to leave?
Not good.
Yeah.
Not good. It was, no, look, this had every indication of being like a disastrous life ahead of me. I'm not even kidding you. And basically, like, so when I got that two-line role on JAG, the world could not have been a brighter or more optimistic place at that point. I'm like,
you were so excited.
I was getting paid to be an actor, and I wasn't going to walk with a limp for 2 weeks afterward. It was amazing. And so then that led to, you know, another co-star where I had a few lines, and then and the roles over time got bigger and bigger.
Battlestar was your first big one.
That was the first one where I was like playing the same character over and over again.
And how long did you do? How many seasons?
Well, here's the funny thing about Battlestar. I was actually, and no one would believe this because I barely show up in season one. Season two, I actually had some cool stuff to do before they killed me off. But like, I had a series regular contract on that show, which is weird. You know, I was getting paid really well because it was a series regular contract, but those contracts mean you can't do anything else. So what happened with Battlestar, and this is my theory. First of all, I saw this incredible miniseries, Battlestar Galactica. It was going to be just a miniseries, but it was a backdoor pilot. And if the miniseries did well, they were going to create a television show. And the miniseries did well. And I was in love with this miniseries. I was like, this is incredible.
So before you even were on the show?
Yes. So I was a fan of it. Got a hold of my agent.
It seems to be your whole career.
Yeah, I'm a fan of something.
You're a fan of something, and then you're in it.
Make me be in it.
I'm going to hang out with you.
That's right. So I literally called my agent. I'm like, you have to get me on Battlestar Galactica. I want a guest star on that show. I want to do an episode of Battlestar Galactica. And she's like, what? Battlestar Galactica? I'm like, trust me, it's amazing. Edward James Olmos, Mary McDonnell, they're incredible. The whole cast is amazing. Get me on the show as a guest star. I want to do an episode. She makes that call. They come back being like, well, there's a series regular role that you can audition for. Long story short, I auditioned. They were like, well, we think you're in the running. Then it's like, no, you're not getting it. Then it's like, well, actually, maybe you are getting it. And the whole time I had no doubt that I actually was going to get it, which was weird considering how many roles I haven't gotten at this point, right,
yeah,
in my career.
Yeah, but you felt an instinct.
There was a weird thing of like, I don't care what they say. I know I'm going to be doing this.
That's so weird.
And then I was on guest starring on NCIS. My head was shaved for some military role. They call me. They say they want you for Battlestar Galactica. They want you to fly out tomorrow. And this is after months after the audition. So I'm like, well, that's terrific. What's the role? We haven't talked about this for months. Like, what is it? And they're like, well, listen, they can't tell you about it right now, but they can tell you that it's a major role and they have plans for it. I'm like, really? Ah, cool. Awesome. Let's move to Vancouver and do it. Then I get to Vancouver and I'm reading the first few scripts and my character's really like not in it a lot. So then I ask David Icke, the executive producer, I'm like, so what's the deal with Crashdown? Where's the character? And he's like, well, I mean, I can't tell you that it's like a major role. It's not like we have plans for him or anything. And I'm like,
what?
Literally word for word, the opposite of what I was told before I signed the paperwork. So I'm like, oh, I get it. They needed someone to sign the contract and fly out the next day, which probably means they had another guy in mind. That didn't work out. And then they needed someone to sign. So Sci-Fi Business Affairs just said whatever they had to say to get me to sign. So then I was like on this show that I loved dearly. But like, and I would see my character show up in script drafts with great stuff. But every successive draft, the role would get smaller and smaller because they had such a huge cast. And all of this cast had been established in the miniseries. I was new.
Right.
So there was no room for this guy. So there would be these amazing little plot lines, but they'd get whittled down to nothing. And so eventually, I was getting paid very well for the first time in my life.
But that's not really what it's about when you first start, dude.
No, because I'm like, I've left my life behind.
Yes.
I'm in Vancouver. What the hell do I do with myself? So I was recording music just to keep myself sane in Vancouver, just recording on my own in my lonely apartment. And in the meantime, I got so bitter and disenfranchised that I said to David Icke, I'm like, listen, man, you're paying me too much to hang out in an apartment alone. You should kill the character and take that money and buy an extra explosion or two. Or you know?
What?
And I did say, and what's funny is you can actually listen to some of the director commentary on the Blu-ray. They actually talk about this story. So I'm not actually making
this
up.
No one has ever said that.
I'm like, kill me. I'm here. Do it. Do it now. Kill me. You know, so yeah, I am.
They took your advice.
Yeah.
They killed you right
they
off.
They did. But what David said and what Ron Moore said, they said, listen, if we do decide to kill you off, we promise we understand you've been upset. And we'll make it up to you by giving you a really cool death. We'll write you some cool material to go out on. And I was like, yes, sure you will. All right, bye. And so then in the hiatus between seasons one and two, I was a bitter, bitter man. And everyone was talking about how great Battlestar was. And I was like, I don't want to hear about it. You know, and I was really bitter about this thing because I loved this show.
And
but
I
wasn't
disappointed
but
you.
I wasn't allowed to participate. I read these scripts and they were some of the best things that I ever read. And I wasn't allowed to do it. So then season two comes around and I get this first script and there's stuff for me to do. And I'm like, yeah, but that'll be written out. And then I keep reading it. I'm like, wait. It's not being written out. So they're like, we need you for three episodes of season two. And in every one of those episodes, I had my character finally had a definite function in these first three episodes of season two.
So how could they kill you off?
Well, but what it was leading to kind of a glorious, amazing death scene. No, but and that's what I wanted.
Right.
So by the end of it, any grievance that I had about Battlestar, I eventually, because originally I'm like, I just want to be on an episode and contribute to that show and then leave. And so here I am with these three episodes where I get to contribute to the show, finally, after, you know, like.
After two seasons.
But, well, it was the beginning of the second season. And so I felt like, wow, Hollywood is filled sometimes with people who are decent, who are just trying to do their best, who have other priorities than some young actor who just wants to, you know, do stuff. And really do, when they say they feel bad about something, mean they feel bad about something. And so I went off, I left that show after I died feeling very warmly about Battlestar and
well,
Ron Moore
good,
and David
right?
Icke. And I ended up becoming a fan of the show all over again. and watching that show all the way to the end. So I became all over again the biggest Battlestar fan on the planet.
Okay, well, that's great.
It was wonderful. I was like, again, I got what I wanted from the show.
Right. Well, you spoke up about it.
Well, and again, to Ron Moore and David Icke's credit, carving out space for a character when you have 12 main characters
is
not easy. And they did it for 3 episodes in season 2 to make up for the fact that they called a kid from L.A. to come and be in the show.
Apartment.
Yeah. Well, and again, and Ron Moore and I have maintained a friendship ever since. So Battlestar Galactica has a very warm place in my heart. Especially since, and here's the insidious
thing. Hold that thought for one second. We'll be right back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The funny thing with Battlestar Galactica is that it created kind of a monster with me, because the entire time that I was on that show, David Icke said to me, he said, here's the rule on this show. Because if you're not happy with your role, change it. I'm like, what? What do you mean? He's like, well, do one take as written, and then just say whatever you want. And I was like, what?
You didn't know you were allowed to do that.
Well, you're generally not allowed to do that.
Right.
So, but this, I've never before nor since had anyone invite me to do that. And Ron and David Icke was like,
which take did they use, yours or theirs?
Generally mine.
Oh!
Anything that was in season 1 where I'm speaking generally has some level of ad lib to it.
That's
sometimes
entirely.
Yeah.
Right?
And so they would be using the stuff. Now, the problem is, since that was a formative role in my acting experience, I have taken that with me, much to the pain and suffering of everyone that I've worked with since, because I have a very ad lib nature on sets now.
How did that go over with being human? By the way, he played a vampire from 2011 to 2014, vampire Aiden Waite on Being Human. Did you ad lib a lot of that?
Yeah, I did.
How was that playing a vampire?
Well, here's the funny thing about Being Human. When I got the script, the show is about a vampire, a werewolf, and a ghost who live together in an apartment and try to teach each other how to be people. And as funny as that sounds like a sitcom, the funny thing is it was actually a drama. But it's a drama where
it was like a dramedy.
The dramedy, yeah,
it
exactly.
It was a dramedy.
It's a drama
because we did laugh.
Yes, and it's a drama where the comedy comes from the fact that these three individuals understand how ridiculous this is, and it's really uncomfortable for them. And so there was a lot of comedy, but bad things happen to these people, this vampire, this werewolf, and a ghost. And the thing that made that show work was that, for example, for the vampire thing, like when I read the script, I open it up and I read vampire, and then I close it because I'm like, I don't want to sparkle. I don't want to do. There's so many vampires. Let's not. True Blood is already doing a bunch of. I don't want to do a goth thing. I'm already pale. Like, let's not call attention to that. So anyway, I turned down the audition, and then a friend of mine called me 2 days later and said, "Hey, she's like, did you?" I heard that you haven't gone in for the Being Human thing. And I'm like, and this is a friend of mine named Laura Terry, who's a producer over at CW now. And she goes, did you read the script, right? I'm like, yeah, I didn't like it. She's like, you didn't read the script. And I'm like, what? She's like, you're lying to me right now. You didn't read the script. I'm like, well, I read like 3 pages. She's like, you read the script now. Read it. So I'm like, okay. She's like, you have one job right now. You're an unemployed actor. Read the script.
Right.
And so I sat down, read the script, and what I realized pretty quickly was that this wasn't a vampire. This was like a drug addict who was trying to go clean. That's how he was written. That's what the metaphor was. That's what this was about for him. And it was a beautiful, beautiful pilot.
Fantastic role.
Incredible, incredible script that really, if you took the words vampire, werewolf, and ghost out of the show, it still worked. You know, it was like, it was really about these people and what they were doing. The ghost
was being human.
Yeah. The ghost was a metaphor for social anxiety and someone who's isolated in their home and is afraid to go outside. And the werewolf, Sam Huntington, played it brilliantly in that he just had anger issues, you know, and
I love that show.
It was a beautifully written show. And so I very sheepishly called up my Dee Dee.
A friend of mine who was his manager.
And I sheepishly called her up and said, hey, listen.
I'll take it.
Can I go in for you? And she grilled me. She's like, you just had me turn this down. What's your deal? I'm like, well, but I, yeah. She's like, you said you read it. You didn't like it. Yeah, but I read it again. And I did it. And I like it. And so she's like, okay, go on in. And it ended up being incredible, like Megan Rath, Kristen Hegger, Sam Huntington. This was one of the hardest jobs to do because the days were
long.
Routinely 16, 17 hours.
Yeah.
Our longest day was a 22-hour day, which ruined us. It was a very, very hard show to do because we had very limited resources, very small budget. And yet I always look back, as exhausted as we were, it was just such a wonderful experience because the writing, Anna Fricke, Jeremy Carver, you know, and their entire group of cronies, in the writer's room, just week after week wrote us the most amazing scripts. And we got to perform this story that we all felt very, very strongly about. And we were just very invested. It was a wonderful, incredible, hilarious, exhausting experience for 4 years.
All right, well, let's get to the good stuff right now. Not that that wasn't good, but this is just so fantastic. And I know this means just as much as being human, if not more, because you are a lifelong Star Wars fan. The love of video games, I don't even know how to describe with you. You're an avid player of the games.
Yes. You've
been doing that since you're a kid or just your adult life?
All the way back to Atari 2600, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, so you must have had a geek stroke when you found out that you were going to be Darth Maul.
Yeah. Well, but I had been having a recurring geek stroke since years before that, because what happened was this. I was at my brother's rehearsal dinner for his wedding. And I get a call from a pal of mine named David Collins, who at the time was a sound designer working his way up at LucasArts, the video game arm of Lucasfilm, owned by George Lucas. And he calls me up and he's like, hey, man, can you step outside for a second? I'm like, I'm at my brother's rehearsal dinner. He's like, seriously, could you step outside for a second? I'm like, okay. And I'm in Chicago. He's in San Francisco. And he goes, listen, man, Darth Vader has a secret apprentice. I'm like, wait, what? He's like, wait, I never said anything. Forget that I said it. You need to send me your reel and your headshot. And I'm like, what's going on? He's like, it's weird, dude. The character looks like you. I'm like, what? And he's like, I didn't say anything. Just send the stuff. Unbeknownst to me, there is this project called Star Wars The Force Unleashed, this video game that they were putting together. And this artist named Amy Beth Christensen created a painting of a character, stylized, you know, but certain facial features, certain haircut, kind of a buzzed look, and kind of a demeanor in the body language. And what I didn't know, and what my buddy was trying to tell me, is like, if you look at your headshot and you look at this painting,
same thing.
It's the same guy. It's a, you know, it doesn't, it's not literally you, but it's a painting that could very easily be you. And this is what they've decided on that they want the character to be like.
And this is without knowing you.
Without knowing me.
Wow.
Without knowing me. And he's like, and later he's like, the reason I need you to send your headshot in is it's not just a voice gig. It's a mocap gig. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, they're going to be using the likenesses of the actors as well as the voice. They feel like there is a connection between the voice and the face and the physical posturing of each actor. So they're hiring you all for the full package, which was not really done. In fact, not done at all in video games.
They never
need that.
Yes.
Make the character look how you want
exactly.
the character to look and then hire the voice actor.
Yes.
And then that's that. But Lucasfilm was like, no, we're going to try this thing. Which, again, what's kind of interesting is that since then, people have been doing it all over the place. Keanu Reeves is now doing it,
yep.
You know?
Yeah.
But back then, that was a weird new thing. So I go in for the audition, and I'm going to go geek on you here, right? So so there's an audition where the character who's been trained by Darth Vader, right? He's been trained by Darth Vader in the ways of the Sith and this evil and fighting and all this awful stuff. But inside, he's a good kid. That's what they want. Inside, he's a good kid who's being trained by this awful parent. And in this one scene, my character is supposed to be meditating and pieces of his lightsaber are floating around and he's assembling his lightsaber with his mind, right? That was the scene. And then he has some dialogue afterward. He gets startled out of the meditation and then he has some dialogue. And as I was doing the meditation, I was white knuckling it. I was gripping my fists and I was tense. And then sometimes I would have these little inhales and I was tense. And after we did the scene, the director goes, why did you do it like that? Hayden Blackman, the writer, director of this wonderful writer. He's like, why did you do it like that? He's meditating. Why were you so tense? And I'm like, well, dude, he doesn't know what meditating is. He sort of knows, but like he's a Sith. He hasn't been trained in meditation. He's trained in fighting and he's tension and aggression. The Jedi know how to meditate. And the moment I said that, I looked through this window because we were in a recording booth at the time with cameras and stuff like that. And as I said that, I looked to the window and I saw everyone looking at each other because I was going geek on them. I was like, well, the Sith are all about this anger, fear,
they
aggression.
They knew you knew what you were talking
about.
The
dark side of the Force.
How did you come up with that voice?
Well, because Ian McDiarmid. Ian McDiarmid when they were shooting Return of the Jedi, 1981, 1982, was like a 38-year-old actor who they made up to be all old to become the Emperor. And I started figuring, well, if he was 38 and he could generate, if he could perform a character, the Emperor, and make us believe they got some 90-year-old actor, there's no excuse for me. I got to learn how to do that. So
how do you do that?
You just... don't drink coffee in the morning. Get really cranky. It's this weird. I don't even know.
Because you kind of contort your face when you, yeah.
Well, that's the thing with voice acting. If you don't also make foreign shapes with your face,
yeah.
Your voice is going to sound the same.
So if you move your lips in a different way, then suddenly, you know, you find yourself making different types of sounds.
That's
all
so
related.
Crazy.
It's kind of like what LucasArts said, that the face and the voice are related, and you can sense that. So,
how many characters in total do you do for these Star Wars franchise animation video?
Oh, God. I think I've done something like 7 or 8 different.
Oh, my God. Gosh.
Recurring characters for them. But so this Starkiller character, Darth Vader's secret apprentice, the game went on to be a big success. And then at that point, the Clone Wars, which was George Lucas's own pet project, which was this animated show, called me up and said, listen, we'd like you to come on the show. I'm like, great, perfect. I love the Clone Wars. Wonderful. And they're like, you're going to be playing in a 3-episode arc. I'm like, oh, cool. What's the role? They're like, you're the dark side of the Force. I'm like, wait, what? So there's this weird episode where they meet a character who, they're in this weird dream world. Anakin and Obi-Wan and Ahsoka are in this dream world. And they meet this character who is the living embodiment of the dark side. And from that experience of working with a guy named Dave Filoni, who the very interesting story with Dave Filoni these days, but Dave Filoni, from that experience of working on the dark side and doing all this stuff and him knowing what a Star Wars geek, through working with me, him discovering what a Star Wars geek I was, caused him to call me up a year later and say, listen, I need someone to do Darth Maul because George is bringing him back into the world after he's been cut in half and we need something. This needs to be right or we're all dead. Can you do it? And it wasn't, are you available to do it or do you want to do it? It was, am I making a mistake by hiring you?
Exactly.
And so when he said, can you do it? I lied and said, yeah, I can do it. You no problem. But we were, yeah. So that's how I started doing Darth Maul. The Starkiller video game character led to me playing a character called the Sun, who was the dark side of the Force. And that led to them thinking who, by the way, had very similar voice to my own, but that led Dave to thinking, well, if he pushes his voice a little bit further, maybe he could play Darth Maul. So that's how that
and
happened.
And that's how it all happened. Now, you're such a fan that when you see the finished product, do you forget it's you?
Well, that's the fun thing about this. With Clone Wars and stuff like that, this animated stuff, Star Wars, Rebels, you do it, you record it, and then the animators take that and animate to what you did.
Yeah, but you, like, live these roles.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that you live it, you record it, but then you go away for a year. And they've been working on it for a year. So you come back not remembering what you did.
And then you see it.
So on some level, as a Star Wars fan, I'm just watching. I'm like, what's Darth Maul up to?
Do you have a Darth Maul doll?
I mean,
we should have a Darth Maul doll, don't you think?
I mean, like, there's one or two, man. Like, but it's for free, guys. They gave it to me. And then the ones that I bought afterward was just supporting. I was just, listen.
We're not judging
you.
No. Hold
guys.
On. I didn't mean it like that. I meant, is there a Darth Maul
and it's
doll,
not a doll
after you?
It's not a doll. It's an action figure.
It's an action figure.
Guys. It's
okay.
I see that we're going to have a great time here on the show.
Rephrase that.
Is
do
terrible.
You have an action figure
sure.
of Darth Maul that is you?
Well, you know what's funny? I have several action figures of Starkiller, the video game character that is literally me.
Okay.
So that's my likeness.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get to that. Somehow I've put you with a doll.
Yeah. And then Darth Maul? Sure. In theory, I have many.
All right. So Sam doesn't do voices and acting, but he also sings. You also play a lot of instruments, don't you?
I guess so, yeah.
What do you mean, I guess? Of course you do. I'll humble brag for him. It's not badly. He does a great job. And you've just released some new indie music. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. The album is called Revenge of the Crash Tones. And it's a
We're gonna play a little bit of it.
It's weird. It's weird because it's basically me, my interest in different genres of music and different eras of music. So the drums are very 19.
Because when I met you, I think you were doing some heavy metal crap.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just making sure.
And I'm still doing some of that, but I'm also, for example, like the drums are very 1960s, played expertly by my friend Tim Hibben. 60s drums, 70s bass lines. 1980s keyboards. So
wow.
There's some synth.
You got every
pop
decade
stuff
in there.
And then 90s guitars. And then to go back, let's go back to the 40s and 50s. Let's go to like some Bernard Herrmann, Day the Earth Stood Still, like, you know, like weird theremin effects and a little bit of John Carpenter type
well,
music.
Well, hold on a second.
There.
Let's just hear a little bit.
Sure. So yeah, you can hear it's several different
it's
genres.
It's very different from what you've been doing.
It's like the Reese's peanut butter cup of music where it's like you try to take good flavors and put them together and hopefully they work. But it's different genres that don't belong together.
And the title is?
Revenge of the Crash Tones.
Oh, I like it.
So yeah.
And if that's not enough, you guys, I wish that we had a camera in here so you could see it. But you know what? I think we're going to hold this up with our picture that we post, because this book you and your brother wrote, Dungeons and Dragons, besides the artwork on the cover, I mean, it is, you know what? It's a visual history. What a great thing. It's actually, I'm stealing that. He wrote that on the book. But it actually is a visual history. This is the most beautiful book I have seen. Honestly, I mean, I got shoe books. I got Manolo Blahnik. I got some books. But this book is, I'm so proud of this book. And it's not even my book. So tell us a little bit about how that came to be. How you decided you want to do that. And then this was some process to get the licensing and everything that you've done in this
book.
It was
like an Indiana Jones-like adventure to even find the artifacts to make this thing.
It's called Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons, Art in Arcana. And what it is Kyle Newman, who is a film director, came to me and my brother and a Dungeons and Dragons historian named John Peterson, who's this very awesome guy who, like, worked in IT, made himself a bunch of money, and then goes, oh, great. Now what do I want to do for fun? You know, like, and so he wanders the world doing interesting things. And so and so he decided he wanted to become an expert on Dungeons and Dragons history. And he is now the expert on Dungeons and Dragons history. My brother wrote a biography of the guy who created Dungeons and Dragons. And Kyle is a lover of Dungeons and Dragons, and so am I. So Kyle comes to me and my brother and John and says, no one's ever done a really good art book for D&D. And as we started talking, we started realizing, you know, moreover, no one's ever really done a historical retrospective on the phenomenon that is D&D. Because it's a cornerstone of pop culture, whether people know it or not.
Well, here's the thing. The reason that I think this book is so relevant right now and should sell the crap out of this book is Game of Thrones.
Well, there
if
you go.
That didn't bring dragons to the forefront,
well, that's it.
I don't know what could
George
do it.
George R. R. Martin himself has said that this was a Dungeons and Dragons was a major influence on Game of Thrones.
Had to have been.
And not only that, Dungeons and Dragons was a major influence on video gaming, on everything. So many pieces of our pop culture that we would never associate with Dungeons and Dragons actually come from that. And we realized, even though we know the history, we know the story of how this was a do-it-yourself
project. Not everybody does.
Yeah. I mean, this was like a guy and his family pasting together these little boxes and mailing them out from his home. That's how it started in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
I mean, come on.
And it turned into this big thing. And it's having, it's now more popular than ever, and people are everywhere playing it and proud to be playing it, which was not the way it was when I was in high school. You didn't tell people that you played D&D.
Where can we get this book?
Amazon. Go on Amazon. Or go to Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble has a...
there's a bookstore still around?
That's right. They have their own edition of the book.
Oh, is that right?
With various special edition stuff in it.
I have to say, you guys, get on it now for Christmas. I know it's only June, but we are headed into July. And you know what happens after July. August, September, October goes like that. So get this book for Christmas. And, oh, there's a DVD.
Actually, that is a PlayStation 4 exclusive.
This is a game?
That is a game. And if you notice, you know how I said, like, the Star Wars game I did years ago.
Yes.
Began this trend of using actors' likenesses, scanning them into the computer and having them be
that's
the likeness.
You?
Yeah, this is like this is what we did in Force Unleashed, except now a decade later, the technology has come so far. So this was a game called Days Gone.
Crystal's going to be playing that.
It just came out. It's basically, it's Walking Dead meets Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, violent.
And I'm very violent. Every other word is F-bomb or whatever. But what's cool is, I mean, it took us... I was on that project for 4 years, and it just released.
Oh, that's fantastic.
We shot 6 hours.
Where do we
scenes.
Get that?
That you can get anywhere. It's called Days
Target,
Gone.
Yeah, anywhere.
PlayStation 4, and it's a very realistic end-of-the-world type game, and you're a biker on your bike trying to figure out what happened.
So this is your likeness on the cover.
That's me.
That's really
I'm
awesome.
The lead character.
It's cool, right? Doesn't
you,
it look like him?
The biker version.
Things have changed since the Star Wars Force Unleashed thing. Like the technology has come so far. So while Starkiller was literally me, this is literally me, but they have little, even my little facial tics and quirks are built into the character.
Oh, that's so cool.
So when I'm watching these scenes in the game, sometimes they're so good that I'm like, did we just shoot that with a regular
film
camera?
That is so cool.
Very interesting stuff.
And where can we get the music?
The music, I think the best way to do that would probably search Amazon for The Crash Tones or Revenge of the Crash Tones. It's also on vinyl, which is fun.
The vinyl is so big again. Vinyl is so big again.
Do you collect? Do you guys collect?
I do.
Vinyl?
She does. I'm not a big collector of the vinyl. I can't. Sorry. But I have to say, buy the book, buy the CD at the same time, then go get yourself the PS4 Days Gone, and you can actually see Sam while you're playing the game, which is so cool. Sam, I mean, listen, this, for a child, much less an adult, is a dream and then some come true for you. And something tells me you're just at the beginning of this crazy adventure.
We'll see.
I happen to think that this book of yours could maybe be taken into the television
world.
We're
exploring a couple things. We'll see
what's
happens.
Next for you.
Well, I just finished with Supergirl. being their villain of this past season.
Yeah, we just had Nicole Maines on.
Yes, who's amazing.
Oh,
I
God,
love
do
Nicole.
I love her.
You know what I love her. You know what was so difficult about that was that Nicole as a person represents...
She plays Nia Nall / Dreamer.
That's right. And as a person, the theme of who Nicole is inclusivity. You know, of just being inclusive, being welcoming, having open arms. And the theme of my character on that show was quite the opposite. So it was, yeah, I love that I have friendship with the people that on screen I hate. It was very uncomfortable to hate your friends on. Yeah, but it's really uncomfortable to hate your friends on screen.
Yeah,
it's not fun.
I bet it's not fun in any world. But that's not fun, much less in the the superhero world.
So moving on, I'm hoping I'll there are some things in the works, and we'll see if they happen. And maybe I'll play a nice guy here and there. That would be great. There's some, again, I can't really announce anything, but I can announce this. This has been announced,
all right,
so I can
talk
about it.
Leave us with something good.
Yes. Back in 2013, I think, Star Wars The Clone Wars was canceled before we could finish the story. We did 6 seasons, and George Lucas had a plan for how that show was going to end, and we were canceled. When Disney took over, they wanted to have their own Star Wars animated show. So they commissioned the same group to do Star Wars Rebels, which we all ended up working on anyway, which takes place at a different time in the Star Wars history. Well, now, Clone Wars is back. We're making it again.
Ah!
Because the fans would never shut up about it, we are now making the 7th and final season of Clone Wars, where we get to finally finish the story as George Lucas intended it. And Dave Filoni is largely the guy who has made this happen. Dave Filoni, who was George's trainee, who was in charge of the Clone Wars. He was in charge of Rebels under George. He was in charge of the Clone Wars.
I assume you and George are pretty friendly.
Yeah, we're best friends. It's great.
that is the best George Lucas!
All I got to say, dude, the man is my hero, so I do that with love. But here's the thing. Dave Filoni, my buddy, who's been the supervisor of these animated projects, is now the showrunner for the first Star Wars TV show, has directed episodes. He's now firmly in the live-action world, and I believe he used his capital at Lucasfilm, as he gained momentum in Lucasfilm, to recreate the Clone Wars, to bring that show back for the fans, to give them the ending that they deserved.
So you see, you guys, you speak and George Lucas listened.
That's right. There
and
it is.
Sam, you are the best. I'm so happy you came in to share all this. You guys, Dungeons and Dragons is the book. Days Gone is the game, the PS4 game on PlayStation. And then the CD is Revenge the Crash Tones on vinyl, too.
Yeah.
Just leave us with maybe have Arnold talk to Christopher Wise. Just something.
All right. All right. Okay.
Yeah, Emperor. I brought Arnold Schwarzenegger to talk to you.
Excellent, Mr. Schwarzenegger. Do you have anything to say in your defense?
Let me tell you something. I'm not intimidated by you sitting there in your big chair with your Death Star around this. And it's like, come on, kill me, I'm here. But really, what are you going to do? You're standing there like an idiot. I'm not impressed by you.
Lord Maul, dispatch him.
I'm not going against Arnold Schwarzenegger, my master. He's very big.
That's right, yeah. Darth Maul's afraid of me. Idiots.
There you go.
You're the best, Sam. I love you.
Thanks
for coming. That's the best.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.